Hello and welcome to the 2009 Full Frontal Podcast.
Hello, Greg. Hello, developers in here.
I'm going to tend to try the ambience in here. So, how's it going? Oh, that's a wonderful lukewarm welcome. How's it going? Yeah. Fantastic. There will be a lot of talks today that will talk about the cool and shiny things you can do with JavaScript. I won't be doing that. I'll be talking about core JavaScript, how it actually works. And like Christian mentioned, we have all these libraries like jQuery, YUI, etc. And you can do amazing things, but if you just hand them to people that don't actually understand anything about JavaScript, it's like giving guns to children, which is entertaining at times, but, well, you want some kind of control. So just to do a quick poll here and to see your level. So who thinks they're pretty decent at JavaScript? Yeah? Who thinks they're better than Remy Sharp? Well, congrats, Remy. That's building a good brand. Okay, so I'll be going pretty fast in the beginning. One of the other speakers, I told him about what I'm going to be talking about and all the things I tried to cover in 45 minutes, and he only said something like brave soul. So we'll see. It'll be fast in the beginning, and it'll be funky and nice in the end, okay? So way back when the internet started, or at least for most of us, there was really nothing we could do with web pages. It was just stale gray things and just horizontal rulers going across, and that was about it. And then one wonderful man came along by the name of Brendan Eich, and Brendan, he had a vision how to make things better and, well, like all people seem to do, invent his own language. And that seems to be the fad again now. And for me, Brendan is someone like Yoda. Brendan is the master, and I really have no idea, but I really, really hope that he lives on a desolate planet in some kind of cottage somewhere, and people go there, get advice, and go home again. So what is JavaScript, actually? It's something that Brendan came up with back in 95. It had a number of names, was Mocha and then LiveScript, and back at that time, Java was going pretty strong, so someone came up with a clever idea of naming it JavaScript. It's not related, but hey, just keep the name, just with Ajax or whatever. Just follow what's the current hype. And in a beta in Netscape 2 at the end of 95 was the first time I actually saw JavaScript in a web browser. And then Microsoft reverse engineered it and came up with JScript, and it was back in 96. And JavaScript is used pretty much everywhere today, like counting characters or fast replies or whatever. I just like this one because it looks all cute at first, but then at least maybe it's just my sick mind, but it looks like something you would pay extra for in Bangkok. But still. And then, of course, it went on. And I think Google pretty much set the pace there when they released Gmail. And we could actually use something online that was, well, actually better than the desktop version. Also, big thanks to someone putting a picture of their Gmail account on Flickr. Thanks. So, doing some research for this talk, I just, you know, for fun, Googled for JavaScript. And the first, the number one search result is Java on Google. I think Google needs to shape up there. But it's also about the common misconception about JavaScript. It's not really related at all. It's just, well, first part of the name and some parts of the syntax, and that's pretty much it. So what is JavaScript itself? It is, as people like to call it, one of the world's most popular programming language, and what defining popular at one time just meant that a lot of people coded in it or broke things with it. But now it actually tends to be popular, and people want to use it on the server and then for every kind of website, and it's got an enormous momentum right now. Because I know back in, well, 05, I think, it was at Media, and Jeremy Keith was talking about JavaScript, and I was like, oh, JavaScript, it's still around. And now 4 years later, we have conference after conference that's just dedicated to JavaScript and conquering the world, which is pretty good to me. I just stick around with the same knowledge, and at times I'm fantastic, you know, the latest thing, and sometimes I'm out. But you know. And the good thing about JavaScript is we have one interpreter on every machine, usually in the form of a web browser. We have some very good standardization going on with ECMAScript. I won't be going into that at all, but there's been some ideas there, and they kind of revised it. But right now, it seems to be going in a really good way, and then we're going to have some nice results there. And also, of course, that web browsers are becoming much faster. We're having sort of a web browser war again in sort of performance, like the V8 rendering engine in Chrome, and we have Firefox, and we have Safari, etc. And it's really fun to write JavaScript, and it actually performs good as well. Well, naturally, we have another browser vendor that, well, they're doing things a bit differently. But actually, to be kind to Microsoft for once, just trying out how it feels, I don't know if I'm going to do it again, but is that just the other day, I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday, they came out with the SunSpider test, which is basically a JavaScript performance test, and the numbers for IE9, how far they've gotten with IE9 now. And, well, I didn't test it, I couldn't verify it, but it looks good. You know, if IE is going to shape up, it's going to be 10 years before we have IE9, but if it's shaping up, we're going to have good performance all across the board, and JavaScript will actually be a nice experience for every user. And when we talk about JavaScript, we have Brendan Eich, and Brendan is the inventor of JavaScript. And the other guy that you really need to know about is Douglas Crockford. And Douglas has made a lot of good work about JavaScript and testing and influencing people. And if Brendan is Yoda, then I guess that Douglas is Obi-Wan for me. And they look pretty much the same, right? And for those who don't know, Douglas is, amongst other things, behind the JSON format. It doesn't take too much credit for it. He basically says that he wrote the spec and left it, and it just exploded. But still, for data interchanging, and he's behind JSLint for, well, not the validating, but looking at best practices for JavaScript syntax, and both from performance and common bugs and errors and such. And he's behind JSMin for minifying JavaScript just to well, make the file be smaller when served from a web page. And usually when I give talks, and I'm different, I'm Swedish, I like to have a theme to my talks. So I thought today we're going to have a Ben Affleck theme. So all the code you'll be seeing here today, and examples, or most of it, will be influenced by Ben. And if we look at the basics of JavaScript, and it's not advanced, but just, you know, take it easy from the beginning, like, var Ben Affleck is an actor, okay? If we look at functions, we just have a normal function, have the name, and just return something. You're really learning something so far, right? But then if we go on to conditionals, we have several types of conditionals. We have if and switch, which we basically have in any language. And we also have nice things like shortened assignments and ternary operators. And shortened assignment is basically, if you want to be a cool guy and do a one-liner, which is almost readable, you can send in a variable here. And here, if it comes in true as the parameter with Liv Tyler, it will just assign that. And you have or in the middle, it will be just default to false otherwise. And ternary operators is pretty much the same thing. It's like an if-else thing, but again, a one-liner. So you just have the question mark here, which is asking the if question. If it's true, we'll return the first value, otherwise the second value. And if you're going to do comparison, and everyone coming from Java and C, etc., they think they're on top of things like JavaScript. That's nothing. I know exactly how it works. But the difference here is that, well, we have one equal sign for assignment and two for equality. But JavaScript also has a funky thing with three equal signs. And then people look at it like, yeah, it has to be a typo, you know, remove one and it'll be fine. But it actually makes, well, doesn't make sense, but there's a reason it exists. And if we look at some code, you know, the first one, that's just assigning something to a variable. But the second one here is that the number 5 equals the string 5, and that will actually return true, while the third one will return false. And JavaScript also has, common short-circuit logic. So you can just check that if the first value, doesn't live up to what you expect, it won't go on. So I see people writing code, and they're just nesting all kinds of if clauses. And you don't need it. You just check the first value, like here, if object exists, okay, check the property of object, and then you can move on, and it won't throw an error, because it won't check the property if object doesn't return true in the first place. And what we saw with the numbers there, that this is number 5 and equals the string 5, is something called type coercion. And it's JavaScript's way of trying to be nice, you know, sort of like writing a document in Word, if you ever do, and it kind of thinks it knows what you want to write, and it kind of fills it in for you. And that's what happens when trying to compare the values. JavaScript, in turn, turns it into the same data type and then compares the value for you, which could be the source of a number of bugs and problems and not really what you expect. It also happens when you're trying to concatenate strings with numbers. It just adds up as a string. So what you could do, especially with the numbers here, is you use something like parseInt or similar to turn the value, make sure the value is of the same data type before you're trying to add it up. Also something that JavaScript developers tend to stumble on is that there are a lot of things in JavaScript that is sort of false, but not really, but it might be in some context. And that's what we love as developers, you know, consistency. So all these values are kind of false or falsy. So if you have different variables here, and we just assign the values here, like null, or we have a variable that doesn't have a value, or zero. Actually, the one that's a bit tricky here is that an empty string is false, just so you know. So if you're going to check this in an if, all returning false. And JavaScript has a number of data types. We have, it's not a surprise, but we have strings and numbers and booleans. We also have the special undefined value. And everything else in JavaScript is object. Object is like the mothership of JavaScript. Whatever happens, it goes back to object. And the different types of objects are, amongst other things, we have functions, we have the array object, the date object, the regular expression objects, and they all inherit from big mama object. And if we want to check the type of a certain value, you can use the type of operator, and we just return the same as you saw with the data type, string, number, etc. So it matches there. So if we have some code there, we can just check a variable that never got a value. It will be undefined. String is a string, numbers are numbers, etc. Nothing tricky there. And with functions as well, you can actually check type of a name. You can get back that it's a function. So, you know, you can call it or work more with it. But where it gets a bit different, we want to check if something is an object or an array, and you check type of on an array, it will return object as well, which doesn't actually give you anything, because it's just object. And if you've ever been scripting in Internet Explorer, you get the object is not an object, and null is null error, message, etc. And it doesn't really help. It's more of mocking you. And I feel the same thing about type of here. But what you can do here to complement the type of operator is using something called instance of. And with instance of, you can check what kind of object it is an instance of. So if you have a regular JavaScript object, it won't be an instance of the big built-in array object, but an array will be. In terms of functions, we have a different number of functions. We have procedural functions, or common functions. We can also assign a function directly to a variable, and then we can just call that variable name, or just be a pointer to that function. can also have anonymous functions, and that just for functions that didn't even deserve a name because they're just doing a small thing, and then we don't need them anymore. We're never going to call them from somewhere else. We're just assigning them directly, and then we'll be working with it. And that's all good, but then it gets a bit fun when you have the self-invoking functions. And the thing here, when we're having functions invoke themselves right away, so as soon as they're read, they're calling themselves. So if you see down here, you have the parentheses at the end that will just make this function run directly. And with functions, we also have arguments that we want to send in. And well, most other languages, you can use overloading and have different versions of a method to give different results depending on what values are being sent in. But there's no such thing in JavaScript. Instead, you just have everything in the same function. You can send in any number of arguments you want. You can omit any number of arguments you want, and it'll just work. Or, well, it won't crash, but then it depends on your content of your function. And to help you with that, there's something built in into every function called the arguments collection. And if you just look at the normal function here, we can just send in a number of parameters. And if this one expects exactly 3 parameters, and if you don't get them, it won't work. And the none here is just not a number. Basically means fail. So with the arguments collection, it's something that you can loop over or iterate over and just get all the values that was sent in. Doesn't matter if it was just 2 values or 500 values. I just want to point out, and it will make sense about 500 slides later, that it's not an array. And why I'm saying that is because you can iterate over the contents of the arguments collection, but you can't use common array methods on it. And there are times when that is actually very useful. So if you use the arguments collection here in a function, just built in, just references with writing arguments, just check the length here. You can iterate over any numbers, and it will just work by magic. And you have sort of overloading in one big function. And when it gets more fun is when we talk about objects. I'm going to create things that this looks like an object for, well, Java developers and C developers, etc. Basically, you just have the name of an object. It is just a normal function, and you just give it a name, and within it, you can assign the properties and the methods, like this.name, this got an Oscar, etc. And then you can just create a new instance of it, like varben equals new ben, and you check the properties. If you're one of the cool kids, you don't want to write the old style way. You want to write the object literal instead, which basically means curly braces. And instead of semicolons, you end the lines with a comma, but not after the last one. And you don't have an equal sign in the middle. You have a colon. So I don't know. I tend to like it, but it at times it feels a bit provocative just to be different from how other people have been doing it. But it's the same thing, like the object you saw before and this object, just the same thing, the same way to access its properties and methods. And we also have different syntax to accomplish the same things in an object, like the first line here is that just, well, assigns the arms property on Ben. Gets a bit sick. And the other one, the dot notation, like Ben.arms, will just assign the same value. The interesting part here, though, is that the first line can take a dynamic value. So instead of having functions where you have 15 lines, you're just assigning different properties, you can just send in what will be within the braces and what will be the property name. So you can just have one line and assign any property you want to an object. Yeah, that one. Always forget my arrows. I sometimes have arrows, sometimes I don't. And also with objects, you can mess them up any way you want to. So if you just create an object and you can just decide for, you know, just for fun, that a property could actually be a number on that object, or it could be a string, or it could be a Boolean as well. You know, why not? Go crazy. It's like coding on acid, I guess. So I heard from Remy. And the nice thing there is that you can also do this with the built-in native objects of JavaScript. You can take the regex object in JavaScript and extend it any way you want to. And why this is a good thing is that, like, well, again, Christian was talking about web browsers and implementations, and we kind of blame JavaScript when it isn't JavaScript's fault. The nice thing here is that JavaScript can sort of back itself up here. So if there's an implementation in a web browser that isn't, well, correct, or you just haven't done it yet, for instance, we had, like, the push method on array objects that came in a bit, well, late in Internet Explorer. So you can just extend the native array object of Internet Explorer and fix the push method for them. Because if they're not going to do it, let JavaScript stand up for itself and just fix it. And that's very, very powerful. And you can pretty much extend whatever you want with it. And also, if we have an object here, we have the good move object. It has a couple of properties. We can just iterate over the properties in that object to get them out, just opposed to the loop we saw before. We actually have an index of each iteration. And we have also had the different values, like an empty string would equal false. There's one way to cover up for that if you're going to do a check in an object. And here we have the year property on that object. And even if that year object would be, well, zero or empty string or something, this if clause would still return true because it checks its existence. It's not trying to redefine the value or type coercion, et cetera. It just checks that, is that value there? Yes, it is. With inheritance in JavaScript, it's not class-based as in many other languages. Instead, it's based on prototypes. And basically how prototypes works, it just checks its own instance and then its own constructor and then its parent and parent and parent. And what it would look like in practice is that just have this being object. It has a property of living, and that's fine. And for the being object, you just create a prototype method called greet. So for every instance of the being object, you can just call the greet method, and it will return the string hello. So then if we have a ban object here, and what happens here is that, well, the ban object is just one small constructor, but the prototype of the ban object is the actual being object. So it will have everything that the being object has and something more. So for the ban object here, we add the says something method that will just work on ban objects but not the being objects. So remember this. So if you create the instance of the ban object and we just call the ban says something method, it will return the value of the method assigned to every ban object. But if you call the greet method, which doesn't exist on the ban object, it comes from the being object, it will just work itself up through the prototype chain to find the origin of the actual greet method. So it does check the ban instance, then it checks the prototype of all ban objects, then it checks the prototype of the being object, and if it wouldn't find it there either, it goes up to big mother object again, because she or he might have it. And usually with prototypes, it could scare people, or some people see it as a challenge to make it look like some other language, like, this is not like Java, I want it to be like Java, can I fix it or break it? And there are a number of implementations, like the first one here is by John Russig, the second one is by Dean Edwards, and the third one is, I think it's by Dan Webb, with the prototype library. And I kind of wanted to include it here because if you follow these links and look at the code in those pages, if you understand that code, there's nothing more I can teach you about JavaScript. That's pretty much how far you can extend JavaScript and objects and making it tricky. What I would like to argument for is actually using the prototype syntax the way I showed it, because that's the native way in JavaScript. JavaScript isn't Java or something else. It's just there right away, and you can just write JavaScript any way you want to, the way it was supposed to be. It's just a personal preference, but I think it's easier to read. But also, it's about maintenance, because I work as a consultant, and usually, you know, you work on some code, and then you leave it to the customer's developer, and then they surface wire environment, they fuck it up. and then you kind of have to go in and fix it again. But it's, if you show them something that is actually native JavaScript as opposed to, yeah, I use my own class Java faking library, so you need to learn that as well, but I won't maintain it, so good luck. I think that's a good thing about prototype because it's just there from the beginning. And coming back to Douglas Crockford, I actually verified with him recently that he still stands by this opinion, so I dare to talk about it. But with calling different super or uber functions on an object, that his experience, and well, he's got a pretty vast experience, is that sure, you can sort of do it in JavaScript, but it's not really meant to. And that's not generally the approach you use with JavaScript. You don't really need it. And scope in JavaScript, which is something you really, really need to know about, is where you can access variable and functions and where might they clash with something. You know, basically, what context am I in and what context can I access? And it's pretty easy with JavaScript. It's a global or a local scope, and variables and functions have the same scope. So if we just look at some code here, if in a JavaScript file you just declare a variable like the var likes to play, it will be global. And then you have a getGame function here. Must be late at night when I choose these names, but anyway. You got a game function here. Within it, you declare a variable like the var likes to play. And that will be a local variable. But if you see just below that, the play online, if you just omit, or usually forget, the var keyword, a variable will automatically be global. And this happens everywhere. People miss it, and they overwrite other global variables. And it's a mess, basically. So always use the var keyword wherever you declare a variable to make sure it's going to work. And coming from other languages, there's also something with block scope, that you only have access to a variable within a certain block. That's not the way JavaScript does it. You know, if you're in a function, you'll be able to access it anywhere in a function. So it's usually a good rule of thumb to just declare all your variables at the beginning of a function so you know what to expect within that function. Again, advanced code. So this is just a global function in a page. But then if we start nesting functions, what happens then? So the inner function here is only accessible from within the outer function. So within the outer function, I can call the inner, I can work with the results, etc., just the same as a variable, but it's just protected within its outer container. And a quote that came recently that I really liked is that don't mess with the global namespace. Some things have to be global, and that's just fine. But, you know, I like this. I like Dimitri's way of looking at it. But it's like the bathroom down here. You know, you don't rub yourself against the urinal or something. You just do what you have to do, and then you get out again. And look at global scope the same way. Dimitri also had some opinions about Google closure, so you should check it out. He seemed to be upset, and it's always interesting when people are upset because they have stronger opinions then. And with functions, people trying to write functions, and they're trying to use the this keyword, but they don't really know what this keyword means. They only know that older, more experienced developers have been using it, so they want to use it as well. So, but you can actually control the context that a function is being run in, and you do it through the call and the apply methods. And that, just as with the arguments collection, this will work with any function in JavaScript. So generally, well, in a web browser, to make it easy, you just have a function here, and you have the window unload here, and just calls docready, and the this keyword within docready will be a reference to the window object. Basically, just the global object of the context you're running anything in. But if you want to control that, if you want to have the set name function here, but you want to call it, so the this keyword in there will be the document object instead. You use the call method here, and the first parameter of the call method is setting the context. So as you see in the setName function, the parameter name there is actually the second parameter just being sent in from the call. And it's just about knowing where you are or in what context you want something to be run. So using this.name here, we'll assign the name to the document object. And here with the call method, you send in comma-separated parameters, any number you want to. You could also use the apply method, which could, well, at times be more powerful. And the only difference is that the apply method sends in an array as opposed to comma-separated parameters. So the good thing here, and we have the call set names function here, you can just take any number of arguments being set into that one and just forward it on to the set names method and just pass on the arguments, so that will be the params for the other function. So what you pass in there as an array will be all the values in the receiving function with the context you're controlling as well. And closures, it's always interesting to talk about closures because they're probably the most powerful and useful thing in JavaScript. And once you understand them, your coding will reach a new level and you'll be happy. So to think about closures, I want you to go to your happy place. You know, just feel good about it. Whatever makes you just smile and just, you know, be happy. And what closures are, it's expressions, usually in the form of functions, and you can just access variables within that context, and you control that context. You can save values within a certain context and reference them later. And in functions, it's are referring to outer functions and to the local variables of its outer function. And that's just a bunch of words. So if we look at some code here, we have an add method here. And the add method returns an actual function, an anonymous function. And within that function, it will just send in the value x here. Like you see, the var add 5 equals calling the add method with the value of 5. And then we'll remember that value 5. So any time from there on that you call the add 5 method, it will just return the initial value for each future instance. And, you know, I just go on and people look like this, and it's like, what, how, really, break? So if you just break the function down, if you have the add function here, and you see that the value x, actually the number 5, is being sent in the first time, it would just continue to remember that value for every other call after that. So if you kind of split it up the way I think JavaScript sees it, is that add 5 actually equals a function that would have the value 5 hard-coded into it, and then just adding it up with the new value that's being sent in all the time. And a very common example is people iterating over something, and they expect the value of I to be the value of that specific iteration of that loop. So, like here, if you create 5 links in a web page, you just loop over them and assign an on-click event. And when people click the link, they kind of expect the alert box to say 0 for the first one, 1 for the next one, etc. But it'll be 5. No matter which link you click here, it's going to be 5. And the error is in here. And the reason is that it's not being called directly. It's just referencing the value of I and just continues to remember its relation to I rather than the value at that time in the loop. So if you use a closure for that, if you use a closure for that instead, like you assign the onClick event here to a function, and also if you look at the function here, it's self-invoking. So it calls itself with the value of I at that time, at that moment in time within the loop. So it sends in 0 for the first link, which comes in as a num variable. And then in the returning function here, that will alert the value of num the time it was assigned instead. All good? Freaky? Just copy the code and it's going to work, okay? I've tried it. Something that I think is inspiring is different approaches to JavaScript without kind of to fake JavaScript in something else. And then Douglas Crockford and other people at Yahoo has been working on something called the Yahoo JavaScript module pattern. It's a catchy name. And basically, it's a singleton pattern. You can use it for several instances, but the origin is that it's a singleton pattern. And what you can do with JavaScript, which isn't really offered by default, is that you can have private and public members of an object. So if you look at some code here, I should actually point out that the Gone Baby Gone movie is a good movie. It started, and you see kind of directed by Ben Affleck. It's like, oh, no, no. But it was actually okay. Anyway, what you have here that I should point to this directly, that you have the Gone Baby Gone variable that is being assigned a function that is self-invoking. So it calls itself right away, creating a closure. And within there, you have any number of variables you want, and the variables declared locally in there will be like private members. And what you have here in the return statement is what will be public from that object. So you can do gonebabygone.title, and it will return the movie title, which it gets from its private member, which is the variable at top here. And I think, I don't know if you deserve credit for Christian, but I think you were, you do? Okay, yeah, Christian. I think Christian was the first one who showed me also an approach that I've come to like over time, to be friends with Chris, is that in the return statement, you can also have just pointers within there to your private members. So it makes it more readable, I think, because within the return statement, it's sort of like an API for an object. So you just have the different methods or properties within there, and then in turn, it's going to reference something that's just hidden away. Namespacing. And namespacing could mean pretty much anything, but what I mean when I talk about namespacing in JavaScript is a way to avoid global variables. Remember, urinal, bad. It's also a way for code structure, and it's also about people like to use inheritance, and they tend to overuse it, and they have a prototype chain that's very, very long. Sounds like a penis comparison, but anyway. And you get performance problems with that, and it's not very readable as well. So what you can do is, using namespacing instead, just create an object here. You create a ban object, and you have a ban.director here, which is sort of a sub object of the ban object. And using the module pattern here, it has a private member and a public method. Then in turn, you can create the ban.actor object, which is totally separate, no relation, but you can, well, through the name, just trying to say that this is also part of the ban universe, but it's not really inheriting from each other. But within there, you can just call something from the director object if you want to, using, for instance, the call or apply method, and call that in the context you want. The first part here is just, if the object doesn't exist, you just create it to avoid an error. And I don't really know where the term came from originally, but having different sort of spice names for coding. But with sugaring and currying code, sugaring is pretty easy. It's what I covered before about, well, for instance, fixing web browser implementations. Like, you have the string object here, and the string object doesn't, by default, have a trim method, which would be pretty useful. So what you do is you use the prototype, extend the native string object, and fix a trim object for it. And from there on, it's going to work for everything in every page in all the code you write. So that's sugaring. Currying is a bit more tricky, and probably my attempt here to just end on a high note, so you'll be confused and won't be asking questions. But if you look at this function, we have the add function here. It takes any number of parameters, like we talked about before. You have the arguments collection. You send in all the values, you add them up, and you get a number. All good? Remember this. Then, we choose to extend the native function object of JavaScript with a curry method. And within that method, like we have the add 8 variable at the bottom here, it calls add through curry and sends in all the values. And it will just remember the result of those values, and then you can just add it up with a new call to that. And just using all the arrows I have left here, is that the first line here is a bit tricky because it's just weird. And the only reason here is that, remember I was talking about arguments, that it's a collection and not an array, and I need to use array methods on it here to make it powerful. So what you can do in JavaScript is that I can just steal or borrow, if you want to, the slice method from the array object and apply it to my own object. So I just take a subset of an object and use it wherever I want to. Then the arguments here will return an array, which is basically just calling the slice method that I stole and using the apply method with the arguments being sent in at that time. I do this because this is a reserved keyword and for that certain call, so I just save that instead in my own variable named that. And then I return a function just to create the values here. And the function being returned here remembers the arguments the first time it was being called, like the number 5 and 3 here being added up. Then it uses the concat method of the array object. That's why I needed to make it an array. And uses the slice apply here to, again, get the arguments the next time it's being called. So it's all a mess, but it's a very, very useful mess, and especially when you're writing more advanced code, you can just save state or save what happened at a certain moment and then just keep on working instead of starting from scratch every time. And when it comes to JavaScript syntax, there's no standard. It's not like HTML. You can't validate it or tell someone that they're wrong or have a little badge in your site like my JavaScript validates. Not that I would, but you know, some people are weird. So what I do recommend is using JSLint because it's based on a lot of good practices in JavaScript, how to do it, how to avoid errors, and small things, just pointing out if you omitted a semicolon or something else as well. And if anything today, my message would be to embrace JavaScript because if you understand all this, this will be extremely useful for all the other parts and the presentations you'll be seeing today. And JavaScript is something else, and JavaScript is rocking the world right now, and it's its own entity. And, you know, if you've been in a relationship and you break up and you move on and you get a new relationship and, you know, you try to get them to dye their hair and dress up as a nurse and do something weird, that's all fine, but it's still not the same person. And the same applies for JavaScript. It's not Java, it's not C, it's not something. So respect JavaScript for it is and try to learn it instead of fighting it. And that's how we JavaScripters roll. Thank you. One. Okay. We've got time for one question.
Well, this might not be a real question, but I would like to ask you to go back to the slide. Slide's gone.
I can do it after.
Anyway, it was about the apply slide where you explained the apply method. And it's just a remark because you're using it as a single, when you call apply and you pass it the array, you access it as an array in the function. While they are actually separate separate variables, so there was a.
Yeah. The difference there is.
That was actually. I just wanted to point it out that you might wanted to change that for the.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I understand what you mean. The thing there was that. Yeah, it's better with code, but in the receiving function, it was just to show that it was sent in as arguments to that function, so you could like. reference them by index. So I have the square 0 to get the first value, as opposed to the call method, where you would need to declare every parameter in the receiving function, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So I would say that we're rather showing how you can access it rather than not, well, it is still an array, but just get the book.
No.
I'm a server-side person, so this might not be useful to a lot of the room, but what's the state of the art of JavaScript debugging? What tools do you guys use to get through this stuff?
Yeah, so maybe I should repeat the question. The question is, what's the state of the art of JavaScript debugging? Or usually, at least for me, because being the opposite to you, I guess, being just front-end focused for most of the time, is that for me, Firebug is invaluable because you can set breakpoints and debug and have logging, et cetera. And it has sort of become the de facto way of debugging and controlling JavaScript, I think, today. But I also know about people with some sort of weird fetish just using IE for auto developing. And there are a number of plugins for IE as well. And I can check it up, but I don't know the names for it. On the server side, on the other hand, or other environments, I don't have any good idea. I guess Christian or someone could say something there because I usually don't meddle around there.
One quick other question. As a JavaScript purist, what's your favorite library of all the libraries we've been hearing about today?
Well,
top two? Top three?
I used to develop my own library, but no one used it. So I kind of like that. But to be honest, it totally depends, and I, like most people, I guess, in here, you get sick of the different fanboys just fighting and trying to be the best library. No library is optimal. It totally depends on the context and we're trying to accomplish and maintenance, etc. And also about, well, other factors like community. For instance, that jQuery is having an enormous boom and a lot of people using it, and you get a big community about it, and you get 5 million extensions to jQuery, et cetera, which might be a good thing. Like, for me, when I'm consulting and I'm going to leave code behind, people want documentation and community and you know, at least the false notion of being safe when I go away. So that's also something to consider. But I think most libraries now have been around for such a long time, and they're very mature. So I would turn around. You couldn't really go that wrong with either of them. So it's more like play around and see how it works and, you know, have fun.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.